It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent weeks, Social Security administrators estimated the program that serves millions of people nationwide, it could become insolvent in about a decade without congressional action. A new poll by the progressive think tank Data for Progress, it finds wide opposition to raising the retirement age for people currently in their 20s. So what is the fix? Be part of the conversation. Call in with questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Angie Chen is a senior research economist and assistant director of savings research at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. Angie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Louise Shaner here, the Robert S. Kerr Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings Institution. Louise, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me again.
Well, let's dive into this downward revision for the retiree fund that will be able to pay scheduled benefits until 2033. And then what, you know, what happens if the program becomes insolvent?
So I'll start. So in 2033, when the program becomes insolvent, or 2034, these are obviously projections that move around, but we understand that the program is not sustainable in the long term. It's actually unclear what happens because Congress is basically faced with two different laws, which is that there's a law that tells you what Social Security benefits have to be, and there's a law that says you cannot pay benefits out of funds that you don't have in the trust fund. So paid funds that come from previous payroll taxes or other taxes. And so we know that the benefits would have to be cut about 20% if that's how they resolved it. But it's actually not clear how that would. There's no rule. It's like, oh, here's how you cut benefits or whose benefits gets cut. So we just get to this position where really Congress has to do something to specify what happens and to fix the situation.
And this is a moving target of depleting funds. I mean, Louise, what would influence when Social Security runs out?
So what they're looking at is the difference between the inflows and the outflows. So the main things that will influence when Social Security runs out in this sort of near term is going to be the economy. Right? When the economy is strong, employment is high, a lot of funds flow through. If we had a bad recession, for example, and employment fell, then the payroll tax revenues that are the main source of revenues for Social Security would decline. So it really is going to be about sort of near-term changes in the economy. Other things matter too, changes in demographics when people retire, immigration. But in the, over this sort of 10-year period, I think the economic conditions are the ones that are most likely to kind of move that data around.
Angie, what do you see from your perspective? How would insolvency affect people who currently rely on Social Security benefits?
I think I agree with Louise that it's a little unclear about how the benefits may be cut if nothing is done in the near term and who might be cut. I think it's also important to remind and reassure listeners that what insolvency means for Social Security does not mean that there is no more Social Security and that benefits are gone. And I think that is a common misperception. It does mean that if there's no solution that is presented, that benefits may be cut, but that doesn't mean that there isn't Social Security.
That's a really important distinction for that word that you are seeing just everywhere. And it can sound really scary because this is what people have been relying on, you know, as they think about old age. I mean, Angie, how much is Social Security woven into our country's social fabric?
I think it is a really important source of income for retirees and for workers who are planning retirement. A large chunk of retirees rely on Social Security as their main source of income in retirement. So any sort of cut will definitely affect their finances. Similarly, for workers, as we know that not, you know, only about half of workers save for retirement on their own through an employer-sponsored plan. And so they're not going to be building up a lot of retirement income to outside of Social Security for a lot of households. And, you know, in retirement planning, people generally think about security as an important source, at least one part of a source of income for themselves in retirement. And so it is definitely a very crucial part of sort of the retirement income solution in this country.
Talking about the future of Social Security with economists Angie Chen at Boston College and Louise Shaner at the Brookings Institution. You can join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Louise, we did see that nearly 9% cost of living adjustment to Social Security payments. I mean, we haven't mentioned the word inflation here, but I do want to dig into that. So there was the cost of living adjustment. Has that pushed the program closer to insolvency?
No, I don't think inflation is really a big part of this story, because when inflation is higher, benefits are higher, but so are our wages and taxes. You know, it's not perfect, you know, year to year, but basically sort of the system is basically indexed against inflation. So inflation is not really the huge worry. It's much more sort of what's happening to, like I said, employment and real wages that matters for the system.
So why is it getting out of balance and nearing this point?
So the basic reason that Social Security is getting out of balance is one that has been foreseen for a long time, which is the demographic change, the aging of the population. So as the baby boomers entered retirement, they boosted the ratio of old people, people who are 65 and older, to the ratio of workers. And so when you think about what's coming into the Social Security system is payroll taxes from current workers, and what's going out is benefits to people who are retired. So when that ratio shifts, when there are more retirees relative to workers, that puts stress on the system, because the amount of money coming in isn't growing as fast as the money going out. And this has been anticipated for quite a long time. I mean, the date has changed as economic conditions change, but we sort of knew for a very long time that we would have to do something about Social Security eventually.
Let's bring on a call, Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi.
Yes, hello. I would like them to address the cap on earnings that are subject to Social Security withholding. I'm wondering how long it's been since that cap has been increased.
Angie, can you field that?
So the cap is indexed to inflation. So it increases every year with inflation. In terms of when it was like a bigger change, that I am not aware of.
Jane, can you add a little bit here what you're looking for in this question? What is on your mind?
Well, there'd been a lot of talk about the wealthy needing to pay longer or pay a significant portion of pay their Social Security withholding at a different proportion than they have been. It's like there's a line where after you earn X amount, then you don't have to pay your Social Security portion withholding.
Louise, do you want to jump in as well here?
Sure. Yes, I can jump in on that. So that's exactly right. So the Social Security system, you pay taxes on a certain amount, only up to a cap, which is about $160,000 this year, I think. And then there's no more Social Security tax after that. Now, your benefits are also calculated based on how much you put in. So the fact that there's a cap also means that the benefits are limited based on, you know, taxes up to the cap. But with increasing inequality in our economy, more of the wages have been at the top of the income distribution. And so the share of wages that are actually subject to Social Security has fallen over time. And so because of rising inequality, people have said, well, maybe we should just, and also we have a system that needs fixing. And so one of the things that is under consideration is to raise the cap or to partially raise the cap and put some taxes on income after. The Medicare system, actually, for the payroll tax for Medicare, used to have that same cap, and they did away with the cap for Medicare as a way of raising money. So thinking about that cap and whether or not we should change it and maybe change it and not lose benefits so that it really is a big source of revenue is something that people definitely discuss.
looking at how to shore up Social Security with a pair of economists, Louise Shaner, Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings. Angie Chen is here, Senior Research Economist at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Call in with your questions and comments about Social Security, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to Jeremy and Racine, who requested we take a deep dive into Social Security. It's a caller-only program where we heard from Jeremy, said they find a lack of understanding on how it's funded and benefits get paid out.
They just don't understand how it works, and maybe that may help us move forward in regards to Social Security reform so that it's more viable.
Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Economist Louise Shaner, Policy Director at the Hutchins Center at Brookings. Angie Chen is here, Senior Research Economist at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. Angie, there's some sentiment out there from younger people who think they shouldn't care about Social Security and they assume it won't be there when they retire. What do you think about that mindset?
Yeah, I think that is a common misperception, and it might be driven by, you know, the headlines saying it's Social Security is insolvent or bankrupt, and not really understanding what that means. And so, yes, we're drawing down on the trust fund, but that's not entirely how benefits are paid out. So as we've mentioned, that the benefits are paid out also through payroll taxes that come in. And so once the trust fund is drawn down, and if no new legislation is that there's no new solution, then benefits may be cut. But that, again, doesn't mean that there is no Social Security and that it won't be around for retirement for younger workers.
Let's bring on a call. Charles in Plover is here. Charles, hi. What's your question?
Hi, I'd like to hear the economist comment on the relationship between immigration and the prospects for Social Security. With our current labor shortage and the long-term prospects for Social Security looking pretty grim, it seems that we need strong immigration more than we've needed in almost a century. And the anti-immigration sentiment among some in this country would seem to help undermine the strength of Social Security, not only helping to undermine the strength of our labor pool.
Charles,
so
thanks.
I'll take
yes.
my call off the phone.
Charles, thank you. Louise, immigration patterns and the impact on this entitlement program.
Yeah, so I agree. I think that a country could use more immigration. I'm sort of my reason sort of broader than Social Security, but sort of people coming in and raising the size of the labor force, raising the size of the economy, does bring in revenues to the Social Security system. They will eventually get benefits if they're legal immigrants, but nonetheless, it is positive for the system, certainly in the near term, but I think also in the long run. And more broadly, our country has always been a country of immigrants. It's a source of our strength. It's a source of growth. And people who have looked, this Congressional Budget Office has done studies of sort of the impact of immigration on the budget, and it is a positive for the budget. So I totally agree that with labor shortages and with, you know, other countries getting a lot of talent that used to come to the United States, our attitudes towards immigration should shift, and we should be more welcoming as we used to be.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, immigration, that word, I mean, it is a very broad word. And so, yes, that is one piece of it. But, you know, how much of an impact really when you're looking at the numbers of people moving into the U.S., what would, you know, is it, can you as an economist even make a prediction as what impact that would have on Social Security?
I mean, the Social Security actuaries, the ones who do the projections, have have assumptions for immigration. That's one of the key inputs into their projections. And so I don't have it in front of me right now. I'm kind of looking for it. But you can go look and see. They will show you what happens with different immigrations to their long run projections. So it's definitely positive. And they make assumptions also, of course, immigration, as you said, it's broad. Like, who's coming in? Are they high wage people? Are they low wage people? That will matter as well. They do sensitivity analysis about, like, what if we increase the rate of immigration, what would happen? I just don't have that number in front of me,
sure.
What that impact is, but you can look it up. They do show that to you.
Let's take another call. Bob in Elko. Bob, hi, go ahead.
My question is, if we took the limit off from Social Security and taxed all of it, all of the income, will it solve the problem?
I'm going to have both of you take that one. Angie, you first.
Yeah, I think the actuaries have done projections on that. I don't think it would close the entire long-run financing gap, but I think it would certainly help increase revenues. But I think it wouldn't close the entire gap. That's my understanding.
Louise, would be one fix and do it, or is there more to it than that?
So so there's two ways of doing it. One is to just sort of raise the cap and also raise the benefits that people eventually get. And that's going to have a much lesser effect on the long run finances, because you'd be both sort of, first you'd get more revenues, but eventually you also have more benefits to pay out. If you didn't do that, it would make a bigger impact. And again, I don't know if it's enough to fix it, but it would be a pretty large tax increase. Right, because the Social Security tax between employer and employees 12.4%. So a 12.4% percentage point on wages is quite large. Sort of thinking about raising the cap is definitely part of it. But you know, when we think about the compromise that will eventually happen over Social Security, which I think is, you know, it's probably not happening anytime soon, given the state of our politics, it will probably be some combination of tax increases, possibly most likely at the high end, I think, and some changes in benefits cuts, could be raising the retirement age, could be other things like that.
Talking about the future of Social Security and its sustainability, Louise Shaner at the Brookings Institution and Angie Chen, economist at Boston College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Angie, you've researched Social Security claims during the beginning of the pandemic, found that claims had fallen slightly in early 2020. What impact has the pandemic had? What have you seen?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that were that kind of happened during the pandemic. One was there was some slowdown in early claiming.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because of the fiscal supports that the government gave out in terms of EIP checks, in terms of generous unemployment for those who did lose their jobs. So that allowed workers near retirement, and particularly lower wage workers, to maybe not claim as early as they would have. So for individuals, that meant that they had slightly higher benefits over their lifetime. And then a couple of other things in terms of with the Social Security Trust Fund, two main dynamics. One was that, because of the pandemic, life expectancy actually decreased a little. And so that affected the trust fund. And then the other side is that the GDP also shrank. And so that also impacted the trust fund. So those are some of the main dynamics with COVID.
Louise, what were the dynamics that you saw in your research?
Yes, so I agree with Angie. At the beginning of the pandemic, people were really worried that we were going to have a really bad recession and it was going to really sort of hurt the trust fund and bring the date of depletion sooner. And really that didn't happen. The worries really didn't pan out, and it didn't have a major impact on the trust fund. And that's basically because the recession was very short. The recovery was much stronger than people thought. And so it turned out not to have been a big deal, but it's an interesting thing to think about. We have a trust fund still. And so if there had been this near-term decline in payroll tax revenues, the trust fund would have just absorbed it and would have brought the date of depletion earlier. You know, as we're looking forward to a situation where maybe we'll make changes, but we won't have a large trust fund, then we'll sort of be more worried about these year-to-year dynamics of when you have a recession, what happens to the ability to pay Social Security. And I think that's something that we need to be considering when we're thinking about Social Security solutions, is to make sure that we create a system that's resilient to things like recessions and pandemics, stuff like that.
Right. I mean, it has to withstand these stresses, these bumps in the road in the economy, because they will be there. I mean, it's
exactly.
Yeah. Talking with Louise Shaner, heads of policy at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings, economist Angie Chen, assistant director of savings research at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. Call in with your questions, your comments on Social Security, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do you put Social Security on a sustainable path, ensuring it's here for generations to come? We're probing that question with senior research economist Angie Chen here at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and Louise Shaner, senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Let's go to Gary now in Brookfield. Gary, hi. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Kate. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to say is neither of your guests have addressed this issue, and it's a major issue that has occurred over the last 50 years in America. When Social Security was enacted, most people got paid a salary or they earned wages, and that was taxable as a payroll tax. But in the last 50 years, vast compensation has been shifted out of wages and salary, especially for the very wealthy, into areas that are not payroll and therefore are not taxed. This also goes for income taxation. They get taxed as if they were investments. And you use someone like an Elon Musk as an example. Very, very little of his compensation is salary.
Gary, thank you for that call. I want Louise to address it. Go ahead.
So that's exactly right. There's been a lot of income of the high income people that's been recharacterized as capital income as opposed to labor income. For Social Security, that, as we talked about the cap on wages, it's at about 160 some thousand this year, and it increases with wages every year. So in some sense, it doesn't matter so much for Social Security because we're not trying to tax all wages. I think if we were in a situation where we said, oh, we just want to tax everything that's wages, then you'd have this situation, which is like, oh, well, but people are recharacterizing wages, and the incentive would be to do it even more if we added a 12% tax on wages. But for Social Security, I think it's less of an issue, at least with the current framework. But it's something that does come up for income taxes as well, and for even just measuring what's happening to the economy and why wages aren't so high. It is true that wages have been recharacterized.
Angie, I want to turn to raising the age of retirement. That, too, has been tossed around. We heard from Becky in Green Bay and called in and wants to know about that, saying, you know, right now you can collect Social Security at 62. What if they increase it? What would that do to the trust fund instead of, you know, increasing the retirement age, but the early age that you can collect?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that's definitely been a solution that has been proposed. In terms of what that means, I mean, that is essentially a benefit cut, because instead of being able to claim at 62, if that age is now 63 or something else, that would be a benefit cut. I think it's important to remember what Social Security is meant to do. It's meant to provide it's not meant to cover all retirement income, but it's meant to provide a baseline for retirees. And not even though life expectancy has increased, and that's the argument that has been given for increasing the full retirement age or the early retirement age, not all workers can work until even 62, which is the current early retirement age. And so having that available for workers that may not be able to work longer is probably important, especially if we think about sort of the distribution of workers.
Yes, and life expectancies with socioeconomic status as well. Louise, what is your take on the age debate?
Yeah, so I think let's be a little clear. So there's two ways of changing the retirement age. There's changing that early retirement age at 62, mm-hmm. And there's changing the full retirement age. In 1983, to try to make the system solvent over 75 years, they gradually changed the retirement age. It used to be 65. It went up to 66. And then after, it's on its way to being 67, depending on when you're born. So the full retirement age is shortly or right now, very soon to be 67. But they didn't change the 62. So that's what meant is if you kept on taking retirement at 62, your benefits get smaller and smaller because you are taking it earlier and earlier relative to the full retirement age. So that benefit cuts. So we did cut benefits by moving up the retirement age. The question on whether or not we should change the 62 is, as Andrew said, it's a more complicated one, because all you're doing when you allow people to take it early is like they're taking their benefits early, but they're taking a smaller benefit so that like their lifetime benefit is expected to be roughly the same, right? So you're going to get a smaller monthly benefit, but for more years. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't sort of save money just to change that 62 to 63 in the sense that then no one would get it 62, but they would get a bigger benefit in 63. And so why would you want to do that? You might want to do that, first of all, in conjunction with raising the normal retirement age also, let's say to 71. Right. And also there's a question of whether or not that sort of knowing that you can get something at 62 acts as sort of just a focal point for people to think, oh, Social Security is available, I'll retire now. And maybe it would be better for them if they kept working. Because one of the best things that you can do to sort of solidify your retirement is not to retire too early. Right. So an extra year of employment and wages can make a big difference. So I think there's a question on whether or not sort of, you know, people are living longer, whether or not we should sort of start just sort of recalibrating the whole system instead of just pushing up the normal retirement age. But as Angie said, and as you mentioned, yes, there's been big increase in life expectancy, but it's been so concentrated on people in the top half or the top of the income distribution and really haven't seen much in the bottom of the income distribution. And so when we're thinking about making these kinds of changes, people are thinking about whether or not we should be a little bit more nuanced about just the same retirement age for everybody, or whether or not we should look at things like your wages, like how many years you've already worked, because people who go to college and earn lots of money start work later as well, right? And so they will have worked for fewer years. So I think these are definitely important considerations as we're thinking about sort of making a Social Security for the 21st century, is recognizing these differences across socioeconomic categories in terms of how much they've already worked, what kind of work they do, how physical it is, and sort of the possibility of keeping people into the workforce longer.
Louise Shaner there at Brookings Institution, Angie Chen at Boston College, a pair of economists giving us some insight into the future of Social Security. With your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike in New London. Go ahead, Mike.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Seth, the scenario is I worked over 40 years at a company, paid in over $100,000, as did my employer. And now I'm retired and receiving over $2,000 a month in Social Security. First question, why is that considered an entitlement by a lot of people? Number two is, what is wrong with the math? This seems like a reasonable annuity to me that I paid in, my employer paid in, and now I'm getting a constant flow of income. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. I want that to feel to Angie. You know, as you look at Mike's situation, what comes up for you?
Yeah, I think that calling Social Security or the FICA tax a tax is an interesting sort of name to give it, because it is like forced savings almost for retirement. I think that the difference is that it's not necessarily in your own account, and it's for the entire system. And his comment about that it being a really reasonable annuity, I would definitely agree that Social Security is a very good annuity, that you pay into the system, and it's one of the best, it's the best annuity you can get. There's no market option that can provide you annuity that is as fair. And so it's certainly a really good source of retirement income for a lot of people.
Louise, as you look at this source of income, and you also have to look at other countries, other models around the world, what should we be paying attention to as we try to fix the system here in the U.S.?
So I'm going to echo what Angie said, which is there's a lot of really wonderful things about Social Security that are better than just a normal, like, you know, savings. Right? Mm-hmm. It's more than savings, it's social insurance. So as Angie mentioned, it provides an annuity, which means as long as you live, you're going to get this benefit. And that annuity market in the private sector doesn't work that well, because the people who buy them are the ones who expect to live long. You can't make everybody participate. So it doesn't work as well. So it really is the best annuity. And an annuity is really important, knowing that you're not going to outlive your savings, right? You have private savings, but you could outlive them. This says, no, if you live till 110, you will have income for that much longer. So it's a really important social insurance system. It's also important in the sense that there's a lot of redistribution in the social insurance system, which is that the replacement rate, sort of how much your benefit is relative to what you put in, is higher the lower your earnings over your lifetime. So there is redistribution, which is a kind of social insurance. If you don't do as well in your career, you will suffer, you know, you will earn less in Social Security, but not sort of proportionally less. So I think we really want to preserve those aspects of Social Security. I don't think personally, I would want to turn it into something that looks more like a sort of forced savings, because there's so much more to Social Security than that. When your caller talked about the math, what's happening is, because Social Security is a pay-as-you-go system largely, it's not a savings system where people take the money, put into, you know, a Vanguard account, it earns interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's a system where the money that people are getting is coming from the payroll taxes that people are earning. So sort of that rate of return that you're getting depends on demographics, right? So when there's a lot of workers relative to retirees, there could be a higher rate of return than when there aren't as many. So what's wrong with the math is nothing wrong with it from a perspective of like it's a fair system. It's just that when the ratio of retirees to workers increases, the math that used to work kind of doesn't work anymore. So I think that we should keep Social Security as a strong social insurance system, but we just need to fix the financing. I don't think there's something fundamentally wrong with Social Security. It's just that as the demographics change, we need to make adjustments. But I think it's been a good program. And as you started off, it's very popular, right? And for good reason, because it serves a very important social purpose to make sure that people aren't poor, or fewer people are in their elderly years are poor than used to be, and then other people, and even in the population.
We have a pair of economists, Louise Shaner at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings. Angie Chen is at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And you can join in on the future of Social Security. Your questions welcome, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The latest estimates from trustees who oversee Social Security say its trust fund that pays retiree benefits will be depleted in about a decade. We are discussing that with Louise Shaner, Hutchins Center Policy Director at Brookings Institution, and Angie Chen, Senior Research Economist at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. Let's bring in William and Aloise. William, hi.
Well, good morning. This is a very pertinent topic considering I retired as of yesterday.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, I'll be kind and say, you know, the federal government has borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. And it's my understanding, well, first of all, I'm curious if it's known how much that is. And it's my understanding if they had just left that there, that the trust fund would be solvent and there wouldn't be any issues that we have right now. I'd be curious to hear the responses, and I'll get off. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Angie, you first.
I think the concern of like whether the government can pay benefits, I think it's not driven by borrowing. It's driven by what we've mentioned, by the demographics that have changed. So lower fertility rates and longer life expectancy. And so I don't think the financing issues that we're seeing is because of borrowing.
Louise, anything to add there?
Yeah, no, I agree. The concern about the borrowing has been really about the fact that when you look at what the federal budget deficit is, it's reported and looked at on what's called a unified basis, which includes the trust funds. So when money went into the trust fund, it was counted as federal revenue. And so like, well, the deficit wasn't very large because we have all this money. And so I think people think is if we had kept it separate, people would have been more concerned about the debt and the deficit, and we might have had different budget issues. But really, all the money that's coming into the Social Security system has been allocated to this trust fund, which is in some sense a fictional thing. It's an accounting thing, but it has been. And so we did build up this very huge trust fund, and it's now being depleted because of the demographics, as Angie said. It's not because the money's not there in some sense. Right. So this is really and the depletion of the trust fund, something we haven't mentioned. It's a legal restriction on the ability to pay benefits. It's not really an economic question. So we could, for example, as one at least short term solution to the Social Security trust fund, just take some general tax revenue, income tax revenues, and allocate it to the trust fund. And then we would be able to continue paying benefits. Right. So it's really, you know, the trust fund depletion is a legal limit, not an economic limit. It's not like, oh, we cannot pay benefits. The U.S. government does not have the means of getting the revenues or the borrowing. We do, but we're just not legally allowed.
As we talk about Social Security and look down the road, you know, I used to appreciate how the Social Security Administration would mail out the statement right before your birthday, like estimating future benefits and different retirement scenarios for you. And of course, that's type of little statement that came in the mail that went away. I guess it was a big mailing. But I'm just curious to you, Angie. Did that make an impact at all? Was that a good piece of paper or a mistake for the agency?
I think reminding people that of their benefits, how their earnings play into role, and what different claiming ages would result in, I think it's beneficial. As we mentioned in this program, that this program is not really well understood by the public about how revenues come in, how benefits are paid out. And so I think the more information that people have about this program, how their benefits are, and reassuring them almost that this program isn't going away is good.
Louise, your thoughts?
I agree with that. I mean, I think people do make mistakes not understanding the benefits of delaying when you start your benefits. So it's really important that people can understand that if they can keep working a little bit longer and not take Social Security benefits till later, that will raise their sort of lifetime income. But I do think there's this interesting question about, you know, going back to people think, oh, Social Security won't be there for them. Sort of they may say that, but it's not clear that in their savings behavior, they're actually doing that calculation. Oh, I have to save a whole lot of money because I won't have Social Security. So I think they like, oh, you know, program, you know, they just sort of say Social Security is not going to be there for them. But they sort of probably assume that in some sense it will be because they're not changing their saving behavior so radically relative to people before them. They're just sort of, you know.
Actions don't follow the words.
I think the actions don't follow the words. And so, you know, information is helpful, but I think it's not 100% clear how much people actually like read it and think about it and change their behavior based on the information.
So as we all kind of scratch our heads here, Angie, what is the best age to retire? Any insight?
The best age to retire is the latest that you can delay retirement, because as we've mentioned, that the later you delay retirement, that increases the monthly benefit that you can get, and that increases lifetime income. And so it will vary by person to person, because for some people, working until 70 is an option, whereas for others, that can easily be done. And so an alternative for those who maybe have some resources but cannot work until age 70 is to use your 401k assets, let's say, to bridge to a later claiming date. And that can also help increase retirement income because, as we mentioned, Social Security is one of the best annuities around.
Louise, I've heard the anthem and you delay, 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 but you also have to balance quality of life.
Absolutely. So I don't think you can ask sort of from a monetary perspective what the best time to retire is. But from each individual has to decide, you know, what the trade-offs are. There's trade-offs, right? So if you retire earlier or you claim Social Security earlier, remember, there's a difference between when you actually stop working and when you start getting benefits. But if you decide to stop working because, you know, you want to enjoy your retirement, that's, you know, it would be important for you to understand what those trade-offs are, but it's obviously a very personal decision.
So as you look forward, Louise, what can people do now to prevent a significant drop in their living standards when they do retire?
I mean, I do think that the best advice, going back to what we did, opposite to what I just said, is to try to stay in the labor force as long as possible, because it's very powerful to work an extra year or two. You know, that's 2 years of salary that you now have and higher Social Security benefits later if you delay claiming. And so that is really a very powerful thing to do. And of course, you know, increasing your saving if you're worried about your standard of living when you're older as well are all preparations.
Yes. And Angie, your best advice, your last word here as closing out, what would you suggest people do to prevent that drop?
I think just reiterating what we've mentioned, that working longer is an extremely powerful tool and probably the most powerful tool. And then saving, and it's for younger workers specifically, it's important to save early and consistently, because that is what really builds up assets for retirement.
Assets over time. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Louise Shaner is Robert S. Kerr Senior Fellow in Economic Studies and Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings Institution, and Angie Chen, Senior Research Economist, Assistant Director of Savings Research at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.